Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. We have some live Uke music coming up here in a little bit in anticipation of Mighty Uke Day 6 with Ben Hassinger and musician Marlo. We'll also talk with an MSU professor who has been studying and working on cold cases, or helping municipalities, helping city police departments clear up backlogs of unsolved murder cases in particular. More about that, and we'll learn about the 30th anniversary of the Sistrum Women's Choir in Lansing later this hour on Current State. Glad you're along today. Sex education will be changing soon in the East Lansing schools. Back on Monday, the East Lansing School Board voted 7-0 to reallow guest educators to teach about sex in the district's classrooms. Now, outside speakers were pulled from the district last spring when a participating organization's approach to teaching abstinence led to a wave of criticism. It began with a series of tweets from a high school parent during an educational session she attended with her freshman son. That parent is our next guest. Alice Drager is an historian of medicine, science, and sexuality who lives here in East Lansing. The 45 tweets she generated while observing her son's class attracted international attention and led in part to her to write a book. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, and other publications. And Alice Drager joins us in the studio to talk about sex education and about her new book, The Talk. Welcome back to Current State.
Thanks, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So outside speakers, outside educators have been approved. These will be coming from Willow Adolescent Health Center Outreach Educational Program and EVE, End Violent Encounters. Willow's affiliated with Ingham County Health Department. Broadly here, how do you feel about reallowing these organizations back into the classroom?
You know, it all depends on what ends up happening, and we'll see what happens. But I have some hopes that things will get better this year. Really, I would love it if our own teachers in the district were fully empowered to do this kind of teaching, and it's somewhat frustrating to me that they're not. But sex ed is a hot potato. It's a political difficulty for a lot of school districts, and ours is not an exception. And so one of the things school districts often do is hire in outside educators, because that way somebody else is dealing with the hot political issue. And if you have to get rid of them, it's pretty easy to get rid of an outside consultant compared to dealing with a teacher.
Listeners of a certain age will remember a day when the high school biology teacher got tasked with that. And it would seem to make sense, but that broadly, that is not what's taken shape here?
They actually do still teach reproductive health in the biology classes in the East Lansing schools. But what ends up happening in the health class is that they deal specifically with sexual relationships and start dealing with the stuff that the state requires, such as talking about abstinence and talking about birth control and these sorts of things. So that ends up happening in the health class in a lot of the classes. And I must say, what bothered me the most about what I observed last year was the inaccuracies that were being portrayed. For example, really overblowing the ineffectiveness of condoms, when in fact, if condoms are used correctly, they're more effective than they were leading kids to believe. They had the kids play a game last year where they rolled a dice, 1 through 6, everybody was assigned a number. And the claim was in the game that 1 out of 6 times you have sex, the condom's going to break and you're going to get pregnant. So by 8 rolls of the dice, everybody in the class was pregnant. The underlying message of which was really condoms don't work. And I don't want my son being told condoms don't work. Mm. They're certainly not perfect. Backup birth control is a good idea. But certainly I would like it if boys understood that condoms help prevent disease transmission, not just in straight relationships, but in gay relationships, and that they're important to use.
Have you been involved with the board or with any of this discussion that's led to where we are today since a year ago?
I did some follow-up right afterwards just to let them know that, you know, I was available if they wanted to talk to me. But I think that what happened with the tweets was so explosive that in some ways I wanted to just step back and let the folks who needed to take over do that. And we have a lot of wonderful people in the district. And in fact, some folks on the school board, many of the high school students, we have a fantastic group at the high school called Students for Gender Equality. And they actually had been working on these issues in great frustration for a couple of years before I came in, and I didn't know that they were doing that. So I really thought they were fully empowered to go ahead and take over and start making the positive changes, and that's what they've been doing. The Sex Ed Advisory Board had not been meeting, and it was supposed to have been meeting according to state law. So the Lansing City Pulse actually uncovered this and showed we were in violation of the state law. So they did start meeting. meeting, they revised the committee. It now includes two high school students who are very feminist-positive young women who think very clearly about sex. And so things, I think, are getting better, but we'll have to see where it goes from here. You know, part of the reason I wrote this book, The Talk, which is a book Amazon Kindle Singles asked me to write, was because it's very clear to me that no matter what goes on in the schools, it's never going to be enough. Kids are always going to hear things wrong sometimes. Things are not going to be communicated well. And so it's incredibly important to understand you cannot outsource sex education to your school. Yes, it may happen in schools, but you absolutely have to do it at home.
Right now, Michigan school districts, my understanding is, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, Michigan school districts are not legally obligated to offer sex education, but if a district chooses to do so, it is required to include content on abstinence. Does information about abstinence, how much information about abstinence belongs in a responsible approach to sex ed for preteens and teens?
Yeah, it doesn't take very long to teach abstinence. It's a simple concept. Don't have sex. And if you don't have sexual relations with another person, there's no way to transmit a disease that can only be transmitted by sex, and there's no way to get pregnant. Although there are other ways not to get pregnant if you want to have sexual relations too, of course, but they don't go into those. So it's very easy, actually, to teach abstinence. The problem with teaching abstinence is the way it's typically taught, and that is to teach it in a way that suggests that any kind of sex outside of a man and woman having sex within the context of a marriage is wrong. And so the real challenge about that is because it has this heavy moral overtone that suggests to kids that if they're having sex outside of a marriage and if they're having sex prior to marriage, that that's somehow shameful. And this especially gets laid on the girls. So I saw this happening in this classroom last year where this guest educator was brought in a guy to tell his story of abstinence and non-abstinence. And one of the things he said to the kids was, when you find the girl that says no, that's the girl you want. And first of all, I was so disturbed by that because I don't teach my son that you go after the girl who says no. I teach my son the girl who says no is the girl you politely step away from, right? That she has the right to say no. But more to the point, what that was saying to all of the girls in the room was the girl who says yes is some kind of slut. The girl who says yes is not the girl you'd want to really be with. And I think that's a terrible message. And that's what ends up getting taught as abstinence. It's not taught as a simple option, in which case you can avoid pregnancy and avoid disease transmission. It's taught instead as a way to give the message that sex is shameful. And I think that's a dangerous, problematic message for kids because it drives sex underground.
Alice Drager is our guest here on Current State. Alice is an East Lansing resident and an historian of medicine and science, a sex researcher, writer, and patient advocate. We're talking about changes in sex education in the East Lansing schools and related topics, including her new book, The Talk. What other kinds of information belong in a sex education class for adolescents?
You know, one of the things I heard from a lot of local high schoolers after the sex ed tweets went viral, a lot of the kids from around here wanted to meet with me and sit down and talk. And I did that with a lot of these high school students. One of the things I was hearing, particularly from the girls, was that nobody had prepared them for the emotional consequences of sex, that they had been told about birth control options to some extent. They had been explained pregnancy to some extent. There had been discussions of how a sperm meets an egg, but that nobody had explained that when you have sex, a lot of times your emotions get involved, that in many cases you and your partner don't feel the same about it, that you may have difficulty talking about it. And so one of the things I really recommend in this book is trying to work with kids to understand that part of the reason sex is so intense is because it can be a very emotional experience for a lot of people, and those emotions can differ. So I wish that in our districts we began to deal with those issues and not just deal with a sort of horror show mechanics of disease and pregnancy, but started dealing with really the lifelong approach to sex that I think is much more positive.
Your new book is called The Talk, Helping Your Kids Navigate Sex in the Real World. To what extent was the episode at East Lansing, did that lead to your writing the book?
It actually grew directly out of it. So what happened was a lot of parents contacted me from all over the world, actually, and asked me, how do I talk to my kid about sex? Because you're right, we can't trust our school districts to do it for us. And so I took what I had learned in my own parenting, but also had learned from doing 20 years of work with parents who have children born with unusual bodies. So that includes children born with sex anomalies, including intersex conditions, parents who had had conjoined twins, parents of kids with dwarfism. And what I had learned from those parents was that a really good way to develop a way of talking about difficult subjects was to try to get off what I call the shame pride axis, which is this place we tend to exist with our children where we're constantly either signaling to them, that's shameful or that makes me proud, that's shameful or that makes me proud. And if we constantly have all our talk around that, signaling everything about shame and pride, then what happens is the kids feel constantly judged by us and they feel unsafe coming to us with difficult questions, with things that confuse them, and certainly with problems because they get the message that problems are things that are shameful. So I really recommend in the book trying to develop a way of talking with kids about sex, but also every other difficult subject, where we try to take back some of the emotion and stop trying to pull our kids to the pride end of the life spectrum and instead just have realistic conversations. I'm really all for reality-based conversations.
Just an excerpt here from your book, The Talk. According to cultural conventions, The Talk is a short monologue about plain vanilla intercourse between, quote, a man and a woman who love each other very much, unquote. In other words, it's inadequate, unrealistic, and ineffective if your goal is preparing your child for sex in the real world.
Absolutely.
How do you contend with parents or anybody here who comes at this from a different angle, who comes at it from any other angle besides yourself? The smart supporters, I suppose. How do you try to persuade? How do you respond to people who look at this morass differently from you?
I try to point out to them that reality indicates to us that a lot of people will have sex prior to marriage. In fact, the great majority of us will have sex outside of marital relationships. And so it's really important that people feel like they can deal with that in a way that is responsible, confident, healthy. And what ends up happening is if we constantly give the message that the only appropriate place for sex is in the context of a marriage, what we end up telling people is everything else is something you should do on the sly, you should do underground, and you should be ashamed of if something goes wrong. And in some cases, things are going to go wrong. You're going to have a disease, or you're going to have some sort of sexual dysfunction, or you're going to have an emotional reaction to a relationship that's difficult to manage. So I think it's really important that people recognize if you really love the people around you and you really want to empower them to have a healthy, positive life and to have positive sexual relations that are built on mutual trust and are not being done on the sly, underground, in hidden places because you're ashamed of what you're doing, then what you've got to do is signal to them that sex is not a shameful activity, that it's a normal part of human life. And that's part of what we started talking with our son really early about, as I talk about in the book, that we started talking with him fairly early on about that the reason people have sex is because it feels good. If it's being done right, it feels good. And that's why people seek it out. It's not because it's some magical thing that only married people do. It's because it feels good. Like eating can feel good. Exercise can feel good. It's one of the things that, especially when you're an adult, it can feel really good. And so we know that when something feels good, sometimes we make bad decisions about it. So how do we think about balancing the pleasure aspects of it with also balancing responsibility to ourselves and responsibility to the people we're engaging with?
Back to the outside educators that will be coming back to East Lansing Public Schools. Will you be attending any of their sessions like you did the SMART sessions last year?
No, my son thankfully is done with that class, and I don't think you're allowed, I don't know, but I don't think you're allowed to sit in classes in which your children are not participating. But that said, we do have, I won't call them spies, but we do have people who are in the classrooms as the high school students who have promised to let me know how it's going. So we're going to find out how things are going that way. And of course, kids today are armed with a lot of electronic devices, and so they're fully capable of doing things like recordings if they want to do that, right, and to be able to report back to the rest of us what's going on in the classrooms.
One question I'm really curious to ask you about here. One noticeable impact of the internet has been access to pornography. As someone who has researched sex, your focus has been the history of teaching, I take it. But what kinds of impacts do you think access to internet pornography is having?
If we look at the data from studies around the world, what we find is that when there's easier access to pornography, sexual assault rates actually drop. And so that suggests to us that it fulfills some kind of need for some people that allows them to get the pleasure that they need without, in fact, harming other people at the rates that otherwise occur. That said, we also know that some sexual pornography is absolutely exploitative. And so we know that it can hurt the people with whom it's occurring. We also know that access, well, we believe that access to that kind of stuff for children can be confusing, upsetting, can send kids down a wrong understanding of the way sex really works. And so we don't actually have data on what happens to kids who get exposed to pornography too early, part of the reason being that it's difficult ethically to do research on children. And certainly you couldn't do a randomized control trial where you expose some kids to pornography and don't expose others and find out what happens to them. So it's difficult for us to know what the effect is on children. But this is like the number one question I get from parents is, how do I talk to my kids about pornography? And so I go through that in the book. And I also talked about it on the Savage Love Cast with Dan Savage a couple weeks ago. The main thing, I think, is being realistic about it and having the conversations as your kids are getting to that age. What is pornography? And the way I describe it, again, is a descriptive conversation. Not getting into, at the beginning, the heavy judgmental stuff, saying it's something that adults use for visual stimulation in order to get sexually aroused, that that's the goal of pornography. And then we've talked with our son, and I recommend talking with your children as they get older about how pornography is produced, that some of it is produced with willing participants, but some of it is not. Some of it is upsetting. How are ways that we can disengage from things that are upsetting, or if things become too interesting to us, how can we manage that level of interest? And start having realistic discussions about that, about how to walk away, how to recognize what's an appropriate interest or an inappropriate interest in terms of your participation in something. Because to my mind, this again models the whole issue of sexual relationships, and it allows us to talk about, did the other party consent to what I'm watching, for example? Am I in a situation where this is a healthy situation? So beginning to have those important conversations.
Alice Drager is an East Lansing resident and an historian of medicine and science, a sex researcher, writer, and patient advocate. We've been talking about changes in sex education, specifically in the East Lansing School District, but also about her new book, The Talk, which is available how?
It's available right now only as an Amazon Kindle single, but it'll be available in print within a month or so. And I just want to also mention that the book I wrote before this, Galileo's Middle Finger, is now available actually in paperback, so people can get that online and through Schuller Books and everywhere else around town.
Alice Drager, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, police in cities with substantial murder rates often find themselves backlogged as they work their investigations. New research from a Michigan State University criminologist and former police officer points to 7 American cities that are solving homicide cases more efficiently. Current State's Kevin Labrie talks with MSU professor David Carter about his study. Mighty Uke Day is this weekend in Old Town Lansing. The event's both a celebration of the ukulele and a means of supporting music education programs in the Lansing area. There will be a lot of live music along with workshops and children's activities. We've invited Mighty Uke Day organizer and self-proclaimed Michigan ukulele ambassador Ben Hassinger back to Current State to preview what's going on. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back.
You can just call me Ben. It's all right. Okay.
The sash is very nice. And Ben has brought along a young musician named Marlo, who will open the show on Friday. Marlo now lives in St. Paul, but she hails from Hazlitt. Welcome to the program,
Thank
Marlo.
Thank you
and thanks for bringing your axe along here today. This is your 6th event of Ben. Has it become what you hoped it would be?
Well, you know, what's funny is that I never even thought it would become this. You know, we just started it out 6 years ago with showing the movie and the Mighty Uke movie, which is a documentary about the ukulele. We had some people hang around and played some ukulele and had a couple beers and had a good time. And everybody, you know, asked, well, this was great. What are you going to do next year? And it was like, next year. And little by little, it's built up into this, the biggest ukulele festival in the Midwest. I mean, people come from all around the Midwest and Canada, all over the place. They come and just have a great time with us in Old Town it's a long day now, too. It starts on Friday and ends on Sunday. So
it's a modest, organic beginning, and then
exactly.
Now you're an event organizer and event planner.
Who would have known?
Let's give us an overview of the kinds of activities that will happen Friday through Sunday.
Sure. Well, what we do, we're actually kicking it off Friday with a flash mob in downtown Lansing, right at the corner of northeast corner of Washington and Michigan. And then Friday afternoon, it's a little laid back. We have some workshops. We have an open mic and group strums at Sir Pizza. Then Friday night, we're going to have our concert, our first big concert of the weekend, and that's going to feature Victor and Penny out of Kansas City, who are a great, energetic duo, and they're actually going to be a quartet because they're bringing their band, and Marlo's going to open up for them, and as well as Megan Dooley, who's quite an ukulele chanteuse out of Kalamazoo. And then Saturday is the crazy day, the absolute insane day, because it starts off with a big group strum at Sir Pizza in Old Town at 9:30. Then we have workshops, open mic. We have a children's workshop and a puppet show we're going to have, and children's crafts. And it just goes and goes and goes until about midnight that night.
Marlo, tell us about picking up the uke a few years ago. You were still living in Hazlet at the time. What did you like about it?
You know, right away, I'll be honest, I didn't know about the ukulele, and I saw a ukulele stand at the Guitar Center, and I picked one up, and I was just kind of strumming. You know, they had a chord chart there, and I, you know, bought one on sale, and I brought it home not thinking too much of it, but then, you know, I got hooked. I learned 3 songs at night, and ever since, I just fell in love with the sound, and like, you know, just the love of the ukulele is crazy. It's the happiest instrument, I think.
Did you have any musical experience prior to that? Did you play an instrument in high school or whatever?
Yeah, I played a few different instruments. My dad was a musician, so I grew up around that. But I originally played guitar, and I played trumpet in the school band. I played a couple string instruments, but definitely had not heard of the ukulele until probably, you know, my freshman year or so.
Could you play a song for us?
Yeah, I will.
You were riffing away here before we went on the air, and you're obviously a really talented player. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play an original song called Battle Royale.
Battle Royale. This is Marlo on Current State.
Thank you.
Marlo performing live on Current State.
Thank you. That was
fabulous.
Thank you.
That is the most virtuosic performance I think I've ever seen on the ukulele.
Yeah. Thank
well,
you, so
you
much.
Know, that's the thing about the ukulele is a lot of people just see it as this easy instrument to play.
Exactly.
But some of the finest musicians I've ever seen are ukulele players. You can really take it just as far as you want to take it.
There's a Wes Montgomery of the ukulele
out there somewhere.
A John McLaughlin.
Oh, no doubt about it.
This marks the first time you have had Hawaiians at Mighty Uke Day, I'm told.
Yes.
Tell us about who is performing.
Excited. Well, a young man named Kalei Gamayo, and he's 28, and I say he's kind of the vanguard of the new ukulele players out of Hawaii. He keeps a tradition, the long historical tradition of the ukulele, but he kind of takes it to new places. So he'll be playing Friday night. We're actually going to have Hula Dancers, the Ho'aloha Polynesian dance group from Detroit. One of the other things I'm really excited about is Chris Kamaka is going to be here. Kamaka is the probably most famous, oldest ukulele company. If you think of Martin Guitars, Kamaka is kind of the ukulele equivalent of that. And they're celebrating their 100th birthday. And Chris Kamaka, grandson of the owner, or of the founder, is coming in. And he's going to give a nice talk about Kamaka at Elderly Instruments and get up and play with Kalei Saturday night and then Sunday at our acoustic concert at the Micah Gallery.
Marlo, how much have you done recording? Where are you in terms of your career right now? Is your career about music?
Yes. I go to college as a music business major in St. Paul at McNally Smith College of Music. Recording-wise, I just got done tracking my second full-length album, 9 songs, all original, and, along with the ukulele, I have, anywhere from a cello coming in to accompany me and, some saxophone, and it's a really, really fun project, and I've been working on it for the past 2 or 3 months with a producer from school, so it's been a lot of fun, and I can't wait to share. It's expected to come out in September.
How exciting. Ben, do you know who travels farthest to come to Mighty Uke Day?
Well, we've had someone from Australia. Although they happen to be going to school in East Lansing. But we get, like I said, mostly from the Midwest. We get a lot of Canadians come over. But we get people like down from the Carolinas and Alabama and things like that.
Impressive. So. That's impressive. Mighty Uke Day 6 kicks off with a flash mob. Is it a flash mob?
If you tell people about it beforehand,
what is up with that? That is at noon on Friday in Old Town Lansing. Headline acts include Victor and Penny on Friday and help me with the name. Kalei Gamayo on Saturday. Marlo will open the show on Friday. Thanks for being here today, and thanks to Mighty Uke Day organizer Ben Hassinger. Thank you, Marlo.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State this weekend, the Sistrum Choir of Lansing will celebrate its 30th year. We'll attend a rehearsal with this all-female chorus and speak with Artistic Director Dr. Meredith Bowen. That and more after the break on Current State. That's trumpeter and vocalist Benny Benack III, along with pianist Francesca Romero. They visited our studio back in March for a very memorable live music Friday. Tomorrow, we welcome Sonny Wilkinson and her spouse Ron Newman. She belts out jazz. He tickles the ivories. Her most recent CD is called A Gentle Time. Sonny Wilkinson and Ron Newman, long overdue here on a live music Friday here on Current State. We hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Police dramas have been a mainstay of American television for decades. Shows like NCIS and CSI routinely depict the labor of investigators, detectives, and forensic scientists as they search tirelessly for the killer of that week's fictional victim. And it's all wrapped up in a tidy bow in less than an hour. Real-life police investigations don't follow such a smooth script. Law enforcement agencies across the country often deal with backlogs, including murder cases. Now, a new study from Michigan State University shed some light on how a few U.S. cities are clearing their homicide files. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to explain. Kevin, who's written this particular piece of nonfiction?
Murder He Wrote, maybe you could call it.
I guess.
That would be Dr. David Carter. He is a criminologist at MSU and a former Kansas City, Missouri police officer. He and his son Jeremy, who's a researcher at Indiana University, studied seven cities who have cleared or solved at least 80% of their homicide cases. Their work appears in this month's issue of the journal called Homicide Studies. So I asked Dr. Carter how he came to study unsolved murder investigations.
I was director of two projects for the Justice Department in two jurisdictions, which unfortunately I can't name, that had very high homicide rates and very low clearance rates. In both of these jurisdictions, major cities, we found a number of things that the police were doing that did not work. And so the Bureau of Justice Assistance said, we know what doesn't work. Let's see what does work. And so as a result, BJA and us identified the seven cities that had clearance rates of 80% or higher for a five-year period. And we went to see how they were doing. Agencies that have 80% clearance rates are doing something very right.
Well, before we get into the specific examples of these seven cities, I wanted to ask you about how a homicide investigator launches a probe into an unsolved murder. Now, all of us have seen our share of these police procedural dramas on TV.
Mm-hmm.
There is no shortage of them, but that by no means makes any of us laymen qualified to to give an opinion on that. Is there really a standardized way of approaching a murder investigation, especially in sort of that golden window of 48 to 72 hours after it happens?
Well, yes and no. And I say yes and no because there's the standard way, but what we found in a study is how that probably needs to be changed. Historically, what would happen is the police receive a call about a potential homicide. That call is answered by a uniformed officer, a patrol officer. Again, historically, what happens, patrol officers respond, and their core role is to, quote unquote, protect the scene. They're trying to identify witnesses and keep them there, trying to protect the evidence of the scene and wait for the crime scene investigators and criminal investigators to come. Crime scene investigators being the people who collect the forensics. Wait for them to arrive and to begin the process. After that, it was just basically a dogged investigation. Let's track down the leads. What are we learning? How are we doing? The first 48 hours is critical. Because of the evidence is fresh, memories of witnesses are fresh, and the likelihood that the offender has got very far is low. Interestingly, kind of a side note on that, one of the things that we did in this study was find out what our successful agencies did during that first 48 hours and identified, I think, 97 separate tasks that they actually do during that first 48 hours. But that model is changing based upon our study.
Can you think of one or two of those 97 that are?
Well, there's a lot of them, and one of them, which is significant for the study, is to have the patrol officers, who are the first responders, not just protect the scene, but take an active role in beginning the investigation, including interviewing witnesses, identifying evidence, recording people potential who may have been at the scene, and oddly enough, that frequently wasn't done. Certainly not the interviewing of witnesses. And so there's a lot of different tasks that, again, individually may seem mundane, but collectively they really have an impact on the change of a homicide investigation.
We're talking with Dr. David Carter. He is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University, also the director of the intelligence program at MSU. Let's talk a bit about some of these cities that you surveyed. They had varying success rates. One in particular, San Diego, had a 100% unsolved murder clearance rate. This is going back to 2011. So in that particular year, 2011, that city was able to completely fill in their backlog of unsolved murders. In a nutshell, is there a way to describe really how that happened?
Kind of. First of all, we actually went to each of these cities. It wasn't just a survey. We actually interviewed investigators and interviewed an extensive number of people there. And again, some of the things that they did, for example, a lot of their homicides were gang homicides. San Diego, as well as some of our other cities, they said, if we got a gang homicide, we need to bring gang investigators in on our homicide investigation team because they know the gangs. We saw the same thing in, for example, Richmond, Virginia. It was very important to bring these folks in In Denver, for example, they found that a number of gang homicides and drive-by shootings were done in stolen cars. So they added an auto theft investigator to the homicide investigation team because they had more expertise in that. So while historically we've always said that, looked at the lead homicide investigator as this dogged gumshoe who tracks down every lead, what our study found was the successful agencies, that's not the case anymore. They're more information managers. They rely on analysis of information. They share resources, and they work with other units.
Including the community.
Oh, the community is absolutely key. I go back to the two agencies that we did that were so unsuccessful in clearing homicide. Their clearance rates were both of them around 12%. And so we asked them, did you do a canvas of the community, which is of the neighborhood, which is very common after a homicide to go out and just start knocking on doors to see people, see what people saw, if anything. These two jurisdictions, they said, no, we didn't do that. We ask them why. They go, people never tell us anything. In all of our cities in our studies, in cities and counties in our study, they went, oh, absolutely. And it's very successful because they had established a solid relationship over a long period with their communities through community policing. They knew they had support from the community for the police. It was a much more open communication. So it really made a difference.
Well, distrust of authority is often a theme in impoverished parts of our country. That seems to be the first battle, is winning hearts and minds and getting people mm-hmm. in the community to trust in the police, wanting to help them, wanting to be part of the solution.
Yep. There's no doubt about it. But that's something that doesn't come naturally. It has to be nurtured, and it has to be consistent to be sustained. Because if the police have a problem and they don't respond to communities, it's hard to work back from that lost ground. So it's got to be a proactive, sustained element by all components of the police department.
One of the findings in your study about these seven cities found that having a fully staffed homicide squad working both day and night, it would stand to reason, seemed to create faster response times. So much of this, though, comes down to staffing and funding. I don't know how many police departments in this country, mm-hmm. probably all of them, struggle with staffing and funding.
What we found, oddly enough, was, and there's some quirks here, that there are jurisdictions who would only staff their homicide unit during the day. That was their regular shift. So you had a homicide at night, then everyone is coming out and has to work overtime.
And is there a greater propensity for homicides at night versus the day?
Oh, yeah, night and midnight. Obviously they occur during the day, but night certainly there's probably higher proportion. So why would they do this? Officers want the overtime. I mean, it's really that simple, and it's convenient. They want to work days, they want to work 5 days a week. So anything on the weekends and nights is overtime. And we found one community that was super prevalent at. So having a day and night shift make with overlap on weekends, at least on Saturdays, those types of things, it not only increases response time, but frankly, really cuts your cost quite a bit.
So at this point, Dr. Carter, what do you hope or expect will come from your study? I imagine the best scenario is for departments around the country to start looking at this and saying, hey, there's a good point, we'll try that.
We've actually had that happen quite a bit. Already, we gave a presentation on the study to at the International Association of Chiefs of Police meeting that we've had had a huge turnout at. I'm going to Wilmington, Delaware, in a little over a week for the Violence Reduction Network to do a presentation on this. As we have two or three others scheduled, we've done webinars for the Department of Justice on this, and so basically, what we're trying to do is share what we learned. Because it's practical, it's inexpensive, and we can demonstrate that it works. I mean, we have evidence that it works, and as a result of that, we've met virtually no resistance. I mean, there's a lot of agencies that said, "Yeah, we're going to try some of these things. Not everything will be implemented, but we're going to try some of these things."
Dr. David Carter, a professor in the School of Criminal Justice and director of the Intelligence Program at Michigan State University, former Kansas City police officer, who has just co-authored a study with his son about the clearance rates for unsolved murders in certain select cities across the country. Dr. Carter, thank you for explaining this to me, and best of luck with this research.
Okay, thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
The Sistrum Women's Chorus of Lansing is having its 30th anniversary concert this weekend. It's an ensemble with a proclaimed mission, part of it to provide a musical haven and to lend a spark to the worldwide struggle for peace, equality, and freedom for all people. The concert also serves as something of a farewell to artistic director Dr. Meredith Bowen, who's led the group of women for half of its existence. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat down with Dr. Bowen to learn more about it. In her words, this feminist chorale.
How would you describe the choir that you have? This is a volunteer organization or audition only?
It's a volunteer organization, and it is the only thing that you need to possess is the ability to sing on pitch. And, you know, we have women here, it's about 50 women, and they're between the ages of 22 and 75 from all different walks of life. Some people read music, some people don't. And I have a lot of second altos, I'll say that, a lot of lower voices.
Now, this is coming up on the 30th anniversary concert of Sistrum, which you've been helming since 2001, so like half of its existence. And from my understanding, you have also kind of brought a dozen women up to 50, so quadrupled the number of singers. That's not a small feat.
Well, right. you know, it's really about good music making and creating community. And when people do that, when you create community and you have a good product, people want to be a part of that. And, you know, it's all about the social justice mission and having a woman's space and being excited about singing music. I moved here in 2000, and I started teaching at Walter French Academy, actually, as a newly minted music teacher. And then I saw this clipping in the paper in the Lansing State Journal saying that this women's chorus in town wanted to have a new director, an interim director. And so I applied, and I think I was the only one. So I became the interim director. And then after a year, they said, okay, you're fine. We'll keep you on. So it's been a wild ride.
Do you program thematically?
I do. I try to build concerts around a theme. This year is the theme is honoring our communities. Last year we had nourishing our community, and where we worked with the Greater Lansing Food Bank, and we donated money and canned goods to them. And so we try to involve community because we are a community chorus. So this year is honoring our communities, and so every piece of music really is focused around speaking to our community.
What are the a few of the pieces that are coming on?
Well, we are singing Arise, My Love, which is one of my favorites by Joan Shimkoe. She's a composer on the West Coast of the United States. And it's about, she takes text from the Song of Solomon and from Shall We Gather at the River, and it's really about the struggle for LGBT rights, and the tagline is there's just one river of love, and it's just one of my favorites. We're also doing another piece by her with a text by Audre Lorde. And the text is, when I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid. And that I think that speaks to many of us in the Sistrum community, and hopefully for women who are struggling identity and and how they can persevere.
Yeah, which is certainly a hot button issue for quite some time.
Indeed, indeed. And that's something that we try to promote in Systrom is equality, obviously. It is a feminist chorus. Yeah. And so it's all about equality and promoting strength of these women.
There was a time a couple weeks ago, I went to my alma mater mm-hmm. in Ithaca, mm-hmm. And I'm going, you know, over to the recital board, and I'm looking, you know, seeing what's there, and this bright blue piece of paper, I'm like, what is that? That's not part of anything. Somebody had gone through the math of everybody's recital, and they said 61 composers, mm-hmm. 4 are women.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of social justice aspect. I came back an hour later, it was gone,
mm-hmm.
but that's something that really spoke to me, that it's still an issue. And that's something that I think Systrom really understands.
Yeah. And, you know, as a woman conductor, and I hate to use that term, woman conductor, I'm just a conductor, right? Right? When you look at honor choirs across the country you know, all state choirs, that kind of thing, I think it turns out to be about 17% of the conductors are women. And usually they're relegated to children's choirs and women's choruses. So this is it's a huge issue for me and for Systrom.
Speaking with Dr. Meredith Bowen of the Systrom Women's Chorus of Lansing. These women coming together in song have their 30th anniversary concert Friday and Saturday at the Plymouth Congregational Church on East Grand River in Lansing.
You've had a few commissions as well to help also get the voice of the female composer into more of the community as well.
It's true. We have commissioned 2 pieces independently, one by Jenny Brandon entitled Dancing Naked at the Edge of Dawn, and one by Andrea Ramsey, Anyone Can Sing. I've also been on the helm of the Sister Singers Network, in which we also commission pieces, and I've commissioned 2, both by Jenny Brandon and Andrea Ramsey as well, through that. So we're trying to bring voice to women composers and women's choruses.
In addition to the Systrom 30th anniversary concert this weekend in Lansing, Dr. Meredith Bowen does have another thing to celebrate, becoming a doctor.
As of last week.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very excited about that and headed to Radford, Virginia in the fall for a job at Radford University.
So this is a complete separation that you're making. How are you feeling?
A little apprehensive. I'm leaving a community of which I've been with these women. I've been with them for 15 years. Many of them have been with me the whole time. And so they've really been there to help me. You know, I've grown a lot under them. They've been with me for 2 degrees, my master's and my DMA. So that's been, I'm a little sad to leave them, but very excited about my future. So it's going to be great. It's all good.
Have you snuck in a few favorites from the years past that are your kind of farewell?
Yeah, kind of. You know, last year...
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
I know. Well, so there is one piece that I added to the concert that we hadn't done before, and it's called I Am in Need of Music by David Brunner, and it's just one of my favorite pieces of all time, and he recently made an arrangement for sopranos and altos, so we're doing that one.
The outgoing artistic director of the Sistrum Women's Chorus of Lansing, Dr. Meredith Bowen. You can see the chorus's 30th anniversary concert Friday and Saturday evenings. More information is available online at Sistrum, that's Sistrum.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's Current State for Thursday. Coming up tomorrow on the program, many Republicans are busy sorting out their feelings about presumptive GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump. I will talk with two mid-Michigan Republican politicos who are uneasy about Trump. Saul Anousis was Ted Cruz's Michigan campaign manager until recently. He is a former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. Also, Jeff Timmer joins me. Jeff oversaw the John Kasich campaign in Michigan and is a past executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Our Live Music Friday guest tomorrow, jazz singer Sonny Wilkinson. She'll be accompanied on our 1936 Steinway Baby Grand by her spouse, Ron Newman. Her most recent CD is called A Gentle Time. We hope you can join us for that. Current State's executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our program today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. The Current State Podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, environmental news, music, theater, stories from around the state. The Current State Podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll be looking for you Friday on Current State.